Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Kentucky pastors sound off about gay marriage.
And it is the complementary relationship of a man and a woman. And so because the government or judicial branch may say they recognize same-sex marriage, doesn't make it a reality.
A former addict urges drug courts to address the roots of addiction.
The scariest thing that they could ever face, which is some of the horrific things that were done to them.
And the American Legion says the VA is a system worth saving.
People have gotten lost in the process. People's claims have been adjudicated improperly. And the American Legion has been very dedicated to make sure that those veterans receive those compensation, that compensation that they've earned.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Okay, last week we heard a lot of EPA regulation speak, both for and against. Now, attorneys general from Kentucky, Indiana, West Virginia, South Carolina, and eight other states are suing the Federal Environmental Protection Agency over those proposed greenhouse gas regulations. The EPA has been required to regulate greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide since 2007, when the Supreme Court determined the gases posed a danger to human health. The lawsuit filed in the D.C. Court of Appeals takes issue with the way the EPA has proposed the regulations. Under the proposed regulations, states will determine ways to reduce individual carbon dioxide emissions. By some estimates, America's forests can absorb up to 24% of the country's man-made carbon dioxide emissions a year. To get those climate benefits, many experts say forests need to be well-managed against droughts, bugs, and invasive plants. But climate change is making these problems worse. As part of the series Climate Chronicles, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
To get to John Burnham's tree farm in southwest Pennsylvania, it's a long drive along windy country roads and deep into the woods. We hop on his four-wheeler through trails and meadows to see the tree stands. He's growing American chestnuts to see if a hybrid of the endangered tree can survive.
So we'll go look at the walnuts and the chestnuts.
Burnham also has a 100-year-old stand of yellow poplar that's ready to be cut and sold.
I probably get a letter or a postcard about every 6 months that somebody wants to help me manage the timber, and they want to come in and cut the trees.
But Burnham's not going to do that. For one thing, he doesn't need the money.
No, I made my living doing other things. I would say this is more of an avocation than a vocation. If I'd be a lot skinnier than I am if I had to make a living off the tree farm.
And Burnham worries that if he cuts the poplars, the land will be overtaken by invasives, weeds like the Asian Elianthus, also known as Tree of Heaven. It's known for its quick growth and foul smell.
I think we would lose control of the next woods that's there, and it might be centuries before we would get back to a woods that we would be pleased with.
Burnham's concerned that if invasives take over, it could harm the native birds, bees, and bats. Tom Martin is president of the American Forest Foundation. It advocates for sustainable family woodlands.
Used to be, if you own land and you let nature take its course, you'd probably get all those wonderful things you wanted in terms of wildlife, water. These days, though, climate change and pests and pathogens, bugs and disease, are really taking a toll on your forest. So unless you're actively paying attention, you can lose what you love.
In recent years, tree farms in the Pennsylvania region have suffered from an increase in invasive plants and bugs. In the south, devastating tornadoes have knocked down large swaths of timber. And out west, droughts have been tough on woodlands. Martin says these problems are getting worse.
Perfect example is the mountain pine beetle. We've had it for a very, very long time in the United States. It's an endemic beetle. I don't know when it first came here.
Martin says the mountain pine beetle is currently destroying virtually all of the lodgepole pine in parts of Colorado and Wyoming.
Why? What's suddenly changed that it's gone from a nuisance to a disaster?
Martin blames climate change.
What's changed is there aren't the number of extremely cold days in the winter in a row that knocks back their population. Just isn't happening anymore. So that pine beetle, which used to do nuisance level damage, suddenly is doing massive damage to a whole species of trees there and is now moving over into the Black Hills and hitting ponderosa pine.
There are similar findings with the emerald ash borer. It's a non-native insect that's been killing ash trees in Pennsylvania and throughout the country. Studies by the U.S. Forest Service find that in places where temperatures get down to minus 22 degrees, some ash trees could survive. John Burnham worries about ash borers in southeast Pennsylvania. Researchers have four testing sites on his property. But Burnham is not convinced the insect and plant invaders he's seeing are connected with climate change. But Louis Ziska believes they are. He's a researcher with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and he has a book coming out. It's about the links that have been found between plants and rising temperatures and levels of carbon dioxide.
In 9 of the 10 field studies, all of them show that as you change the environment, specifically as you add more CO2 or a warmer temperature, it's the invasive species that respond. And that has huge ramifications.
Ziska says research finds that unwanted plants, such as poison ivy and ragweed, thrive under higher temperatures and levels of carbon dioxide. It's James Finley's job to talk with large landowners about this and other issues related to climate change. Finley is a professor of forest resources at Penn State University. He says the more native trees and other species that survive, the more forests will be useful in sequestering carbon dioxide and reducing the impacts of climate change. But he says many landowners are similar to John Burnham. They're doubtful about climate change.
Can I say global climate change to you? Probably not, and keep you in touch with where I am. But I can at least begin to point you toward making decisions toward a healthy ecosystem, which is going to be more resilient. And so I'm asking you to play off the idea of stewardship rather than the idea of global climate change.
And that's how John Burnham thinks about it. He's doing what he thinks is best for his trees and the ecosystem of his property. And it's fine with him if that benefits the climate. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at alleghenyfront.org. Meanwhile, in West Virginia, members of the State Kanawha Forest Coalition gathered at the Capitol Thursday evening to rally against an approved mine site just 1,500 feet from the forest's edge. The State Department of Environmental Protection approved the permit in May, although officials say the proposal has been in the works for years. Coalition members say the mountaintop removal mine will greatly impact the plant and animal life in the state forest. Ashton Marr brought back these sounds from the rally.
Kanawha State Forest! Save Kanawha State Forest! Save our forest! So may it be.
So why are we here? 3 months ago, the West Virginia DEP issued a permit for a mountaintop removal mine less than 600 feet from Kanawha State Forest, less than 1,500 feet from people's homes, and less than 5 miles from where we sit right here at our state capitol. Many of us came together 1 month ago at our meeting in Kanawha City, and we worked together since that meeting to gather thousands of signatures asking Governor Tomlin to revoke the KD number 2 surface mine. We're here today, petitions in hand, to send a loud, clear message to Governor Tomlin. Protect our mountains, protect our health, protect our community, and protect Kanawha State Forest. Revoke the KD number 2 surface mine permit.
My knapsack on my back. Valdirie, Valdira, Valdirie, Valdira, Valdirie, Valdira, my knapsack on my back. I love to wander by the stream that dances in the
West Virginia hills. How majestic and how grand, with their summits bathing glory like a...
How can you tell me this is going to destroy my well? And oh, by the way, now getting city water is going to be at my expense. How is it okay that real estate agents can tell me that the day the permit was signed, my property value dropped 50%? So whenever these coal people get in my face and say, well, if you don't like it, leave. How? Can't sell my house. And really, why should I have to? I love living across the street from Kanawha State Forest. It is gorgeous out there. I have fallen in love with where I live. And I want to stay there. And I'm so grateful. I'm sitting here just looking at all these people, and I don't feel like I'm fighting alone.
And my friends among those West Virginia hills. Oh, the West Virginia hills.
Last fall, I hiked up the mountain next to where the mine is now with my dad and my sister. And they hadn't started to do anything on the mountain yet. So when we looked across the valley, we saw a forest. It was full of colors because it was fall. About 2 weeks ago, I hiked up there again with my dad, and we saw, instead of the forest, we saw, like, mud, stumps. It made me really sad because I go down there a lot, and I really care about Kanawha State Forest. And I hope that everybody else who cares about Kanawha State Forest and doesn't want their water to be dirty and their air to be polluted, I hope everybody else helps as much as they can, because I am.
I think of happy home and my friends among those West Virginia hills.
Still to come, some folks in Appalachia are looking up for their energy, way up. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Finding an accurate count of homeless people is a challenge, but one organization in West Virginia says it's growing. The Union Mission is a Christian organization that's been in operation for 102 years. CEO and President Rex Whiteman worries that the growing number of people facing homelessness is not going to end anytime soon in the state. This week, Roxy Todd visited Union Mission's Crossroads shelter in Charleston to find out the struggles of being homeless.
Hey, my name is Carl. I'm in Charleston, West Virginia at a homeless shelter. I ended up homeless in 2009 after dropping out of school.
This is Carl Probson. He works as a chaplain at the Union Mission Crossroads homeless shelter. It's right underneath the interstate as it overpasses downtown Charleston. It's not a place many people notice. A few years ago, Carl dropped out of college and found himself on the streets in Virginia Beach. He only had $79.
I was on the streets in Virginia Beach, Virginia. I called Greyhound, and I had just enough money to go to Charleston. And so I ended up in Charleston.
Here in West Virginia, the story of poverty is not often told by the people who are living in the midst of it. Too often, the conversation doesn't even happen, and when it does, it ends up perpetuating the stereotypes that persist about the state and Appalachia as a whole. That's part of why Carl is still here at the homeless shelter, working to help those who are down on their luck, as he was.
You know, the experience, I think, changed the way I looked at things. It's changed the way I viewed situations and people's lives, and I do know that some people choose to be homeless and some people just end up homeless.
The director and minister of the Crossroads shelter, David Sneed, was homeless on and off for about 19 years.
We recently had a big increase in the amount of people that we do help. Well, I wouldn't be afraid to say there's at least about 25 to 3,000 homeless people just in Charleston.
Dave's job includes going out in the middle of the night, offering people water, hot soup, and sandwiches.
The people that you see in Charleston, just Charleston alone during the day, is not the same people you're going to see walking around at night.
On an extremely hot and muggy night a few summers ago, Dave and another chaplain from the mission were handing out water and sandwiches to people. Two blocks from the shimmering gold of the Capitol building, they saw a woman who was leaning against a fence. Dave offered her a bottle of water and two sandwiches.
She asked for three more bottles of water and six sandwiches, and we gave it to her. And then she started crying, saying now she wouldn't have to go out and prostitute her body. She could stay home and feed her kids.
Another night last summer, Dave says he will never forget. They were handing out water, this time on the west side of the city.
One of the little kids was a little girl, about 2 years old. Her mom gave her that little 8-ounce bottle of water. She was just gulping it down. She was so dehydrated.
That girl finished the water and began to cry. When you haven't had enough water, you can't make tears. They gave her another bottle of water and then another. It was so hot and muggy, and she was so tired that she continued to cry as they gave her 4 bottles of water. Dave has been doing this work for about 10 years. In the past 2 years, he says the number of people in need has increased as the economy in West Virginia has suffered many job losses. Since 2012, the number of men staying at the Crossroads shelter has doubled. Like many of the chaplains and caseworkers at Union Mission, Dave was once homeless himself. He grew up extremely poor in a small town in Maryland. He was abandoned first by his father and then by his mother.
These people don't know what love is. I didn't know what love is. My father, when I was 6 months old, threw me in a canal. He picked me up out of the crib one morning and walked down to the edge of the canal there and threw me in a canal.
As a baby, Dave was rescued from the water and then spent the next 6 months in the hospital with malnutrition and pneumonia. As an adult, Dave reunited with his father.
I love my dad. You know, my grandma said, oh, he tried to kill you, and you still love him. I love my dad.
But it took Dave a lot of hard years living on the streets and at least 4 close calls with death before he got to this point of forgiveness. And he points out that many people who are homeless have been hurt and abused. But one of the things that hurts the most is whenever he hears people making fun of someone on the street. He knows the pain of that, too.
I guess the whole time that I've been saved and sober, I just tell people, you know, homeless people is not the outcasts of society. They just made some bad decisions like I have in the past. And I just try to hug him and tell him I love him. You know, I believe in tough loving.
For both Dave and Carl, that tough love includes helping people without judging them.
There are a lot of hardworking poor people, and we shouldn't turn our backs and just point our finger. We should try to understand what's going on in our communities before we start pointing a finger. That's what people should know.
This story was produced by Roxy Todd, Dave Mistich, and Ashton Mara as part of the 24-hour radio race from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. As electricity rates continue to climb, some communities are coming together to try to offset their bills by harnessing the power of the sun. It's still a pretty novel idea in West Virginia and other parts of Appalachia, but communities are forming co-ops to help make it happen. Glennis Bort of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
Solar cooperatives are a newer trend where communities are using their collective powers to navigate the world of solar energy. Consider Anya Schulman. She lives in Washington, D.C., and when her son pushed her to go solar in 2007, she decided all the research and effort that went into it would be worth it if she was doing it for a whole neighborhood.
And so he made up this flyer with his friend Diego. They went door to door, and 2 weeks later, we had 50 homes signed up, and no idea what we were going to do.
Oh, jeez.
So that's how we got started. It ended up, for the first group, it took us 2 years, and we took 45 houses solar as a group.
Schulman says ever since then, other neighborhoods have been coming to her, wanting to do the same thing. So she started and became the executive director of Community Power Network. In the last year and a half, the nonprofit has helped 16 neighborhoods in D.C., Maryland, Virginia, and now West Virginia pull together to make installing solar panels a more attainable goal.
And it's really just taken off.
Emily Stever with Community Power Network.
People are really excited to go solar, and by going with the co-op, you're able to get a better price, but also support of all of the co-op members throughout the process. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we provide the technical assistance to help answer your solar questions and review bids. But the members of the co-op are the ones that are really driving the process forward.
Stever says the two communities in West Virginia, one in Monroe County and one in Fayette County, approached Community Power Network, and each community has different ideas about how they want to go solar. People like Ginger Dance of Fayette County.
We just found out about this opportunity through, because we've been doing a lot of energy efficiency work, and somehow we found out about it. So we invited them here because we knew that Fayetteville would be an excellent place to find people that are interested in this kind of thing. And we've had a lot of local interest in getting solar panels for people's homes at an affordable price without a lot of money up front.
Price, technology, incentives, how to. I mean, if you're like most people, you have nothing but questions. So this is how solar co-ops work. You join a co-op or start one for free. Anyone who is interested signs up for free. There's a competitive bidding process to choose an installer. Whoever is chosen by the co-op then does individual site visits and creates and offers custom designs to meet community needs. Then you buy together in bulk, saving anywhere from 10 to 20% on cost of supplies and installation. In Fayette County, so far, about 27 residents are part of the solar co-op. Stever and Schulman met with community members to answer general questions and to help people like Tom Omley.
I believe that solar is a good option. Want to explore it and see if my wife and I want to put in our home. You know, concerned about, do they tear up anything or all the wires hidden? Just what does it do to the house and being on top of a hill with high winds and those things? Those are my real concerns. Can we see it when it's done? Typical questions, what's it cost? How much do I get back? What's the payback? At age 70, I'm more sensitive to a payback than I was at age 30. I'm excited about it.
But prices vary dramatically based on many factors. Stever with Community Power Network says $8,000 to $15,000 is a good estimate for an average home these days. And there are special incentives worth considering as well, like a 30% federal tax credit. Simply put, the next time you file taxes, you can write off 30% of the total cost of installing solar panels. It's an offer that may expire in 2016. And there's also net metering, which Schulman explains is written into West Virginia's law books.
You can reduce your electric bill 1-to-1. For every kilowatt hour of electricity you produce, it reduces your bill by that amount.
Schulman says when you're generating electricity, sometimes, depending on your electricity use, you can create more energy than you use. And when that happens, you create credit with the electric companies. That credit can carry over month to month and can last years.
The solar that you produce this year might be worth, you know, $500 or $600, but electric rates have been going up and up and up and up. So that same amount of power that you produce 5 years from now might be worth $1,000. So the cumulative savings that you have from the power you generate is worth 3, 4, 5 times what the system actually costs, even before incentives.
So Schulman and Stever laid out all this information for the folks in Fayette County and Monroe County, and they put out a call to solar installers. This week, they announced Fayette County Solar Co-op's decision to go with Appropriately Applied Technologies, or AAT, a company out of Ohio. The company's proposal focused on quality of materials to guarantee a maximum lifetime of the systems, as well as other technical perks. But another key aspect of the proposal focused on partnering with the community to create jobs locally. Both Fayette and Monroe County co-ops will continue to accept any interested parties through September. The co-op members are slated to be outfitted with solar panels by the first of the year. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Fayetteville.
Two cases are moving their way through the U.S. Court of Appeals systems that could affect bans on same-sex marriages in states like Kentucky and West Virginia. A ruling by the 6th U.S. Court of Appeals in Cincinnati in favor of gay marriage could impact marriage ceremonies at some Kentucky churches. Kentucky Public Radio's Stu Johnson talked to pastors at two Lexington churches about their approach to same-sex marriage.
The summer is a time for vacation Bible school at churches across Kentucky.
Such was the case in July at Lexington's Ashland Avenue Baptist Church.
We've heard two things about God so far. On the first night, we heard how God is a creator. Now he created all of you with a reason and a purpose.
That was also the case at Bluegrass United Church of Christ. The pastor at Bluegrass United Church of Christ is Marcia Moores Charles. She's led the diverse congregation for 3.5 years. Moores Charles is gay and just this June traveled to Massachusetts to legally marry her longtime partner, Brenda.
My idea of the theology of marriage is that God endorses and supports and celebrates when any two people can find love and companionship and commitment with one another.
David Prince, pastor at Ashland Avenue Baptist, believes marriage is, in his words, a union between one man and one woman who are to be exclusively devoted to one another for the purpose of companionship, procreation, and communal good.
The Bible defines marriage as that, and not only the Bible, but really 2,000 years of civilization has transculturally defined marriage in that way.
Prince says everyone is born in the midst of a fallen world with what he describes as sinful inclinations. He believes homosexuality is one of many sins found within society. The Baptist minister says his church has never conducted a marriage between two persons of the same gender and will not start no matter how the courts rule. He says the U.S. government and courts didn't create marriage and can't redefine it.
Marriage is a particular reality that God designed, and it is the complementary relationship of a man and a woman. And so because the government or judicial branch may say they recognize same-sex marriage, doesn't make it a reality as far as what marriage really is.
Prince says if marriage is redefined from a legal point of view, every church in America will be forced to clarify where it stands. Marcia Moores Charles of Bluegrass United Church of Christ admits many Kentucky churches are not likely to change, even if the ban on same-sex marriage is lifted. She says churches that already allow clergy to conduct blessings of same-sex unions would continue to conduct weddings, but could add the line, "By the power invested in me by the Commonwealth of Kentucky, I now pronounce you." Moores Charles says churches that don't believe in or support same-sex unions would still have the right to refuse to conduct them. Moores Charles and her partner Brenda had a wedding ceremony in August of 2012. They once thought a legal ceremony was not necessary.
I can tell you that we thought, well, you know, we've been together, we've got the commitment. It's not a big deal to have a ceremony. It is, because it is validated by community. We do lots of things in community. We bury people and have funerals so we get community support and so that we are surrounded by people who love us and embrace us. And I believe the same is true for marriage.
At her church, Moores Charles says there are families of many types. She says there are moms and dads and dads, and moms and moms. While she says it's important for children to have both male and female role models, Moores Charles says it doesn't have to come only in marriage. Chad Linton, a member of Ashland Avenue Baptist, does believe a man and woman in marriage amounts to a picture of the gospel. He says it's not to say raising children in a mom and dad family doesn't bring with it challenges.
You know, your mind is limited again, so you don't know how to handle every situation, and all children are different. So as a husband and wife, we try to raise our children as biblically as possible, but we still make mistakes, and every family does.
While David Prince has preached on the issue of gay marriage in his church, it's not a prominent sermon topic in many houses of worship. Marcia Moores Charles says she has acquaintances in ministry who say they agree with her position on gay marriage, but don't speak about it in the pulpit.
And good or bad, oftentimes what we find in churches, especially very large churches, very powerful churches or denominations, is that it is about the church politics and the church budget. Because those folks have said to me, I can't say that from the pulpit or I'll lose my job.
Helping out with Bible school on this July night at Bluegrass United Church of Christ was Hattie Leaf. She says her attitudes about homosexuality have changed through discussions with her 9 children.
I really don't feel like I'm the one that has any say-so about people and who they choose and their lifestyles. but I had to learn that.
At Ashland Avenue Baptist, local restaurant manager Trey Corbin believes gay marriage is wrong according to God's standard. He believes his attitude is a minority view on the gay marriage issue. Corbin says love, care, and concern should be shown to all, no matter their sexuality.
We need grace, we need love, we need to know Christ. And so at the end of the day, you know, my view on gay marriage doesn't define me, nor should anybody else's view of gay marriage define them.
While there are theological discussions and debates about gay marriage in churches, the matter before the courts comes down to the question of a legal definition of marriage. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Stu Johnson.
In late July, a 3-judge panel of the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled Virginia's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. That case is now being delayed with expectations of appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Without a delay or stay, Virginia would have had to have start issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples within 21 days of the ruling. The state's attorney general has also asked the Supreme Court to look at the pending decision. That's the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys, possibly one of the longest-running bluegrass bands in West Virginia. And we'll hear more about the Pocahontas County Band in just a bit. Stick around. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Some Kentucky judges and attorneys are looking into ways to best apply new research into brain science to better serve the state's 115 drug courts, which offer an alternative to incarceration for drug offenders. Kentucky Public Radio's Jonathan Meter has more.
When he was 10 years old, West Huddleston's father began to physically abuse him so severely that, later in life, he required 2 back surgeries. The trauma drove him to drug abuse, and that, in turn, contributed to the breakup of 2 marriages. Now CEO of the National Association of Drug Court Professionals, Huddleston told a packed conference room in downtown Louisville's Galt House Hotel that when he got sober in the 80s, he didn't get treatment for his PTSD because it wasn't widely known at the time. He told drug court officials and staff to take advantage of new research to address the underlying roots of addiction.
I promise you, you'll have better outcomes, and your clients will have a much easier way toward recovery if you help them and you guide them to deal with the scariest thing that they could ever face, which is some of the horrific things that were done to them.
Kentucky Supreme Court Justice John Minton says that drug courts are a boon to those in recovery as well as local government coffers.
A drug court is, it saves lives and it saves money for the taxpayers of Kentucky. And of course, you know, each community has limited resources in terms of treatment, dollars that are able to be spent on these things, and it varies from place to place. So we try to provide as much uniformity as we can across the state.
The administrative office of the court says that for every dollar spent on drug court graduates, the state saves just under $3 it would otherwise spend on incarceration. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Meter.
The U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs has been rocked by scandal in recent months, with reports of long wait times and rigid wait lists. But the American Legion has stepped up to say the VA is a system worth saving. As part of that effort, the Legion has launched a series of town hall meetings and set up temporary command centers around the country to help answer questions veterans have about their benefits. West Virginia Public Radio's Sarah Lowther Hensley has a look into a recent visit in north central West Virginia.
It's mid-morning, and so far there's not much of a crowd inside American Legion Post 31 in Shinston.
a paper sign taped next to the front door states that this is the Veteran Crisis Command Center entrance and lets veterans know they're in the right place to ask their questions and get some answers.
It's so hard to predict who's going to come, when they're going to come.
That's Zachary Hearn, Deputy Director for Claims for the American Legion National Headquarters. And about 35 veterans took advantage of the first day of command center operations.
I know our director, Verna, she made it a point. She said if one veteran walks out of here with benefits that they never saw coming, it was all worth it in the end.
Hearn says $17,000 in benefits was awarded on the spot to two veterans who came the first day. They'll receive retroactive payments in addition to their future benefits. He says it's a great feeling to help veterans learn about the benefits they've earned.
What it's really proven is how the American Legion and VA should be working together. And once we get outside of the Beltway into Middle America and really helping veterans on a one-on-one basis.
Hearn says one veteran at an event in North Carolina had been trying for nearly 20 years to get his claim approved. At the command center, it was resolved in about 20 minutes. But these temporary command centers are only around for a couple of days. These events, in some ways, have also turned out to be good train-the-trainer opportunities. Hearn says American Legion posts have trained local service officers in place to help veterans at other times.
Well, my name is Donna Peter, and I am the service officer for both Post 67 at Sistersville, West Virginia, and for the 4th District, which includes, if they were all active, 13 different posts.
Donna Peter drove over to Shinston from the Ohio Valley to learn more. She says she's new to her job of service officer and found the information and outreach very helpful.
It'll give me information where I can send people or like your suicide prevention and things. I'll know somebody to send them to for help.
Both Peter and Hearn agree that communication between the VA and veterans needs to improve. Peter says she's heard from some vets that they got very little instruction about their benefits before being discharged. But she also says it's human nature to not soak everything in, even when told. She and her husband were connected with the Air Force for 20 years.
When I got out, we had told people what to do, but you don't know if they're listening. You have family meetings on base, and you try and let people know what to do when they get in the civilian world. But you go to those things and you're bored to death, and you don't listen like you hoped they would.
Another breakdown involves the complicated nature of the benefits themselves. Hearn says the process can be complicated and tough to navigate. For example, he says veterans don't always realize VA health care and VA disability benefits may intersect at times, but are two very different things. So the outreach efforts will continue, with hopes of helping veterans and restoring confidence in the system.
People have gotten lost in the process. People's claims have been adjudicated improperly. And the American Legion has been very dedicated to make sure that those veterans receive those compensation, that compensation that they've earned.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Sarah Lowther Hensley in Shinston.
And in Kentucky, for 39 years, the Korean War ex-POW Association has held an annual reunion. It's an occasion when dozens of American veterans who were held prisoner during the three-year Korean War in the early 1950s can share a few days together and remember those who died in captivity. As Kentucky Public Radio's Rick Howlett reports, this year's reunion was the last.
The reunion has been held across the country since 1976, including seven times in Louisville. They're always held in late summer to coincide with the date that many of the prisoners were released. Army veteran Ed Fenton has tried to attend as many reunions as he can when they're not too far from his home in Hampton, Virginia. Fenton, now 87, spent 2 years and 8 months in a North Korean prison camp. He was forced to march there after his capture.
It took us quite a while. Walking about 300 miles by the time they got done with it.
Ed Fenton and more than 80 other ex-POWs and their families spent nearly a week in Louisville, where there were outings to the Kentucky Derby Museum and other sites. There was also a memorial service to honor those who died in Korean POW camps and daily gatherings in a hospitality room at the Brown Hotel, where they could catch up and share family pictures. That's where 87-year-old Chuck Elder recalled the day he was captured by the North Koreans. He was a prisoner of war for 2 years and still carries some shrapnel more than 60 years later.
hit by friendly fire, wounded the day I was captured. Treatment was bad. Food was bad.
Because of the former prisoner's advancing age and difficulty traveling, the group decided that this year's reunion would be its last, although the association will remain intact. Chuck Elder, who still lives in his hometown of Hydes, Maryland, says he'll miss the fellowship and camaraderie.
It's good for me to get together with these people every year. It's a lot of fun and it's helpful.
Ed Fenton was accompanied by several family members for his trip to Louisville, including three young grandchildren. He, too, was wistful about the final reunion.
That hurts because we've been released and things, and we enjoy what we have now.
One of the continuing missions of the Korean War ex-POW Association is to ensure that those still missing in action are not forgotten. They number more than 8,000. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville.
This is Inside Appalachia.
Now my love, she's gone away. She's in heaven, so they say. Well, you tell her for me that my love will never die. Someday I'll lie alongside on that golden way of thine.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Recently, we've been picking around to find out more about the music of Appalachia. The mountain melodies and skills are often passed down through generations. So, to end the show, we're going back, about a year and a half ago, when we first heard about the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys. The band's possibly one of the longest-running bluegrass bands in West Virginia. The Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys began in 1968 in Pocahontas County. We're going to hear from Richard Hefner, who was one of its founding members. Hefner grew up in Mill Point with his family, where his mother Elsie ran the post office and served as the matriarch to a family of humorists and talented musicians. Elsie's brother, known as Uncle Dude, taught Hefner and his brother Bill to play music. The three of them formed the band with friends Harley Carpenter and Dwight Diller, and wrote many of their songs in the family home at Mill Point. Today, over 40 years after the band was founded, Richard continues to live and perform close to Route 219 with the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys.
Gone away, gone to stay for a million lonely days. I'm so far from the home, far away and all alone.
If you've been around Pocahontas and Greenbrier counties long enough, you're bound to have heard or seen the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys performing their traditional style of the hard-driving, high-lonesome sound. The band may be the longest-running bluegrass band in West Virginia today. Richard Hefner started playing banjo when he was young, and in the 1960s he helped start the band that has been a big influence for many bluegrass bands around the area.
We started about, well, as I can remember, 68. We got together here at the house, you know, and then we just started to getting out playing, going to churches and fire departments and doing things like that. And then we got on the radio then finally, and then we played the state fair.
Back at that time, the boys were in their 20s. And Richard's uncle, Glenn Irvin, who everybody knew as Uncle Dude, was playing mandolin. Uncle Dude helped teach Richard and his brother Bill to play music, and he also introduced them to a lot of old country and bluegrass tunes.
Uncle Dude, that lived with us most of the time, the one really taught us all how to play music. He was born hydrocephalic and water on the brain, and he got polio when he was five, and he learned how to play the harmonica And from there on, he learned to play every stringed instrument there was, I guess. He played, he was an incredible guitar player. He played Merle Travis, Chet Atkins, played mandolin really good. He was our first mandolin player.
In 1971, the band recorded their first album, Pure Old Bluegrass.
We did it in January 1971, and it ended up being an 8-track tape. That's when 8-tracks were popular, and that was with me and Harley Carpenter and Brother Bill Hefner and Uncle Dude, Woody Simmons and Dwight Diller. We went to Waynesboro, Virginia and cut that. We did that thing in a day. We did it the way you're supposed to do, standing in a circle and everybody, you know, if you mess up, you have to start over again. You don't stop and do it over, you know. It's a different thing.
That would be the last recording with Uncle Dude, who died in 1974 at the age of 41. In the mid-70s, the band's personnel continued to change. But Richard and the rest of the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys decided to take the music on the road.
We went to New York City and auditioned, and there was all kinds of people there. There were magicians and acrobats and country music and everything else. And one of the agents picked us up for, they wanted a bluegrass band. So we got on the coffee house circuit and got to playing colleges and stuff up in the Northeast mostly. And we'd leave and stay gone for 2-3 weeks at a time, go up maybe through Pennsylvania, over in New Jersey, and up through New York, and back down around, stay home 2 or 3 days, and load up and go to different places. And we did that for, I don't know how long, probably a year, year and a half, something like that, and it finally got to be pretty hard.
In the end, Richard and the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys settled back home in West Virginia.
It was fun. I wouldn't do it again, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. I'm so far
from the home, far away. Today, if you happen to find yourself down in Lewisburg on a Friday night, you might be able to catch the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys at the Sweet Shop, which is in downtown, right off Route 219. Richard's got some different faces in the band, but the music has stayed true to the original bluegrass sound.
Yeah, we've been in that one little bar down there. We play there every other Friday night for 22, 23 years, something like that. We're so far apart, we never see each other, so it's kind of our get-together practice place.
This story was produced by Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project. The project is a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio. It's supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the West Virginia Humanities Council. Next week, we'll hear part two of the story as Richard recalls the story of his Uncle Dude, Glenn Irvine, who was in a wheelchair for most of his life after suffering from polio as a young boy. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, WHYY in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Other music heard on today's show was by And Walk Softly on This Heart of Mine by Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys.
Walk softly, oh, that heart of mine, love. Don't treat it so unkind.
We'd love to hear from you. You can talk to us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can send me a tweet at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.